This podcast examines issues on violence driven by gender inequality, a global health problem that is likely to have personally touched the lives of our listeners. Take care while listening and email svri at svri.org for resources. What does it truly take to shift the balance of power and control, to lift us out of gender inequality and violence? Tackling it one issue at a time is not going to cut it. Our focus must be on deep, systemic change. We need more funding for research, and that funding needs to support locally rooted coalitions. The question is, what does it take to achieve that? Welcome to the first episode of Series 3 of the Sexual Violence Research Podcast from the SVRI. I am Elizabeth Dartnell, and our vision is to see a world free of violence against women and violence against children. And in this podcast, we learn how to make that vision a reality. In today's episode, we're discussing what it takes to create just and inclusive systems for change, the role of philanthropy in disrupting and challenging existing power structures, and whether it's possible to shift societal norms. Today's guests are Varya Lipovsek, Director of Learning, Measurement and Evaluation at CoImpact, a major new player in the world of global philanthropy, and Duncan Green, Senior Strategic Advisor at Oxfam GB and Professor in Practice in International Development at the London School of Economics. He's also the author of How Change Happens, which shows that it is possible to make major changes towards a more just world through concerted action. So Duncan, what made you start really thinking around how to do things differently in terms of development and how to make change in different ways?
Great question. I think it was trying to understand the history of particular change episodes, communities I've talked to in India and Bolivia, all over the place. I had this lovely role in Oxfam where I was going around talking to communities and campaigners about what had happened, and then trying to put a kind of system on it to try and sort of see a structure of how change happens. And crucially, when is that change sticky and when does it get easily reversed? And I think that kind of thing got me thinking about systems, got me thinking about power. And I kind of defaulted back to my undergraduate days as a physicist, which I thought I'd left forever. And that actually was quite helpful.
Super interesting. I'm going to actually ask a very similar question to Varya. As a philanthropist and trying to do philanthropy differently, how are you really thinking around how to disrupt change and building collective action within countries?
Lovely to be here. Thanks for the question. So collective change, I mean, from the philanthropy perspective, I think there's two ways to kind of think about it. One is, I think there's a growing trend, a growing number of organizations that are thinking about working in slightly different ways than has been the kind of usual, right? And one is philanthropy and development actors working collaboratively together. And the other one is about really employing what kind of at the broad level gets called like a trust-based approach. Now, everybody thinks about it slightly differently, right? Like, what does it actually mean? And how do you apply that? And for CoImpact, the kind of the main idea there is to really lean into the vision of change of the people in the context where they have been living and working in, often for decades. And so rather than coming with a predetermined vision from the, let's say, global north or the philanthropy view in terms of what needs to happen, but really understanding what is it that organizations that have been working at a front line of certain really tough problems, right, which are actually often systemic problems if we're going to get into systems change. So collective action, both at the level of philanthropy understanding this and coming together, but also to fund in a different way, because collective action is also very much at the country level. So not at all thinking about one organization, one funder, but really about what is the coalition of actors that needs to come together to make sustainable change happen.
Amazing, because we really want to make sustainable change happen. And to do that, there are so multiple moving parts. But Duncan, I want to go back to you around your thinking around what radical redistribution of power and opportunities and assets is looking like, and what is really required when we do that to break that cycle of poverty and inequality that we are seeing all around the world, rather than trying to rejig or just reinvigorate existing models of development and charity.
Yeah, I think for me, the starting point is power, right? And there's all these different kinds of power. Sometimes it gets a bad press. People think, absolute power corrupts absolutely. I think that's a terrible starting point for thinking about power. Power is what everybody's looking for. Power is like one of the best frameworks is from Jo Rowlands based on women's empowerment in Honduras, where she says, let's think about power within. When is the light bulb moment that people get power? You know, that when they realize they have rights and they can get angry and that's good. And then how do they form power with? How do they come together in the kind of collective action that Vaya is talking about? And in order to achieve power to influence how governments allocate resources, how governments pass laws. Now, all of that stuff requires you to make power visible in some sense, become power literate. And there are various tools you can use to do that. And then that helps you, when you get a change, think about what's going to make this change irreversible. Because there's lots of changes which are then reversed. But if you can shift power permanently in some sense, then you can do a kind of shift in the system to a place where you won't go backwards. So I think that's the point on sustainability, that power helps you make change sustainable rather than just a momentary victory and then followed by a defeat.
I was listening to a podcast about how that we have to really be wanting power, because power can be such a powerful lever for change. So just to really affirm what you're saying around, it's not a bad thing, power, but it's how we use it and how we define it, and moving away from power over, but moving towards working with power with. And that brings me to ask you, Vari, around doing philanthropy different, and sort of how does that issue around understanding power and power and control influence the way that Co-Impact works with your grantees, of which we are one and very proudly one grantee? How are you finding that in terms of empowering your partners to really do what they need to do in their own contexts? Or have you found that? And in sometimes have you not found that, and why?
Yeah, so completely agree with this sort of the all-pervasive importance of who wields the power to do what, right? And traditionally, I think it's safe to say that philanthropy has very much wielded power one way, and that has been from philanthropy to organizations that are almost seen as implementing actors, right, to kind of implement somebody else's vision of what needs to happen. And I think at Co-Impact, we'd like to contribute to upending that to the extent that we can, and actually demonstrating a different way of working in a couple of ways, or in a few different ways. One is the fact that we don't dictate any organization's vision, strategy, ways that they need to work, who they need to work with, and by extent also not what they need to measure, what success looks like, what are the outcomes that they want, all of that. We look for organizations that are deeply rooted in the context, understand what's going on, have the relationships, the longevity to work with the systems to get to that, as Duncan was talking about, kind of to be able to help shift and systems shift in a way that the change that you want to see is baked in, that it's hard to kind of undo it once the political winds bring about some change at the top, right? So that means that we really get behind the vision and the strategy of the organizations that we support. Maybe a small signal, but we like not to call them grantees, because we don't think they should be defined by the fact that they get a grant. We like to call them partners. Maybe it's cosmetic, but it means something, I think, to us. And then it's not that then, you know, our model isn't, okay, we have funds to give and then we just sort of disperse and back off. We do engage, but I think it's how we think of that engagement. And the ways we like to think of ourselves is, for example, road support, right? And what does that mean? That means that the partner is in the driving seat in terms of, as I said, defining the strategy, but also really importantly, adapting and pivoting, because as we all know, it's about politics, it's about power in the context. And so organizations need to be able to call the shots and make the decisions as to what works best and to actually shift things along the way. And that doesn't work if they're wedded to some blueprint that a funder came up with, right? And so really, we want to think of ourselves as road supporters, to be there when that shift needs to happen and to help to understand that and to help to support it, right? And so that's the kind of a funder that we want to be. And the other thing about power and understanding power and the politics of it is that we fully trust that our partners are the ones who get this in the context and in the system that they are working in. And so it's not for us to try to unpack and figure out which coalition they need to be with, or which is the window of opportunity that is coming up. It's really us putting the trust in our program partners that they can figure out the power dynamics and the politics in a particular context, and to support them through it.
I mean, as a funder, and we also do funding, sometimes we do actually have to have outputs and produce something and people have to actually deliver on things at times. So what does it look like in practice to have this really trust-based relationship and working with folk? And then also, I'm not sure how Co-Impact gets funded, but often if you're getting funded through big intermediaries like international NGOs and philanthropists, sometimes we have other people that we have to report to. And so some those guidelines, outcomes and outputs are really get very rigid as it gets lower down the chain of who's receiving those fundings. So how does what does it look like in practice when we find a partner that isn't really delivering? And, you know, so big call, for, of course, when we're trying to redistribute or rethink around power and control, particularly in the funding environment, is more core funding, less program-based funding to allow us to be able to implement the politics that we care so deeply about in our work, because all of this development work is in some way ideological and deeply political, particularly in the gender world. And when the milestones, project outputs become very concretized, the politics and the passion and the rage often that I think you spoke about, Duncan, earlier gets a little bit diluted, and we have to then to report and not able to be as flexible as we'd like to be to dealing with the context on the ground. So that was a long interjection. But what does it look like when it's not working, and how do you manage the issue of actually requiring a report and actually requiring an output and really wanting to see change on the ground when sometimes that change is difficult to measure and is nuanced and is something a little softer than a 500 workshops or, you know, because policy change, for example, at a big level isn't always a direct line from doing something on the ground.
You're right. And it is not as simple as sort of just saying, well, you know, we all want to see change happen and we're going to put funding towards that and we're going to, you know, and wonderful things will grow from there. As a funder, of course, we come to an agreement with program partners or research partners, such as yourself, in terms of, you know, what do we think, what does the partner think is the likely trajectory of change, right? And so, and I say likely trajectory of change because we understand that when you have to plan. If you're not going to plan, you have no idea where you're going. So every partner that we support has a pretty darn good idea in terms of what positive change in their context, in that system concretely might look like. And they have a pretty darn good idea as to what are the kind of strategies they might employ to get there. So that's the plan that they come up with. We support them in ways that we find that we can support them. We try to find other organizations or other support out there that can help them do this. And then we sort of say, right, at the start, at year zero, we're going to have a joint plan, which ideally any sort of measurement that the program partner decides to design that is commensurate with the plan also serves their own purpose. We don't mandate any evaluation approach. We don't mandate any indicators, right? We have certain parameters as to what we fund and we don't fund, but really it is up to the program partner to decide what good looks like, what is that success and how they're going to track and measure that. And so that's the plan at year zero. And then, you know, program partners go on and sort of put their strategies into action. And then life happens, right? Politics and elections and COVID. And so, and I think what is deeply important is that we as a funder understand that. And that plan isn't a straitjacket that boxes people in and has them doing 500 workshops when 500 workshops are no longer necessary and are just the wrong thing to do. But it allows the program partner to sort of say, hey, we were going to do this, but given what's happening, we're going to change and pivot. We're going to do something else entirely, right? And so, on the basis of that, you still have outcomes and outputs and reports and, right, that intelligently describe what is the program partner going about doing? How is that manifesting in the system that they're working in? Are the changes that they were expecting to see start to happen in the system, are they happening or not? And how they might shift, right? And so I think from the point of view of accountability, you can have the entire accountability system set up very well, but you're prioritizing learning and the change that a program partner needs to put into place, not some sort of a predefined plan that the funder came up with and was wedded to the 500 workshops or whatever it was. And then if I can quickly go to this other point that you made about, yes, it's true. I mean, Co-Impact, we have our own set of funders and we get asked the question all the time about, well, how does this all add up? And, you know, how can you say what you're achieving at the level of your portfolio? And frankly, here's where we prefer to take the brunt of the kind of challenge to make sense of it on us rather than pass that brunt of the challenge to the program partners by dictating something like, okay, we need to make a composite picture, therefore everybody must measure X so that we can add all the X's up together, right? So that's not what we want to do. And yes, it is challenging to sort of aggregate things up, but that's why we invest a lot in learning for ourselves as a team, in sense making with our program partners, in ways that can kind of help to further the global conversation in terms of, and Duncan can speak to this, like, how does change happen? If you're trying to shift a certain system in a certain context to produce better results for women, for girls, for people, then what are the different elements in which that you need to address within the system? And what are the different sort of levers, like power, like, you know, mental models, et cetera, that you need to think about how a system functions? And prioritizing that learning, I think, is more important for us to sort of make the aggregate picture and the argument as to why invest this way than some very sort of simplistic adding apples and apples, which is not possible in this world.
So I'm going to then sort of revert to you, Duncan, around from your experiences, where can you provide an example of how change has happened and why you think it happened, thinking through that complex issue of systems change that Varya has spoken about?
I will answer that question, Liz, but I also want to just ask Varya a question, if that's allowed.
Yeah.
It's really interesting what she's saying. But, you know, you can go so far with a really smart organization like CoImpact. You know, you've got good intentions, you've got good rules of thumb for how you feel about partners, you've got systems, you get rid of some of the rubbish in terms of reporting and compliance and all the rest of it. But there's some underlying issue which you're going to bang up against at some point, which is power follows money, and you're the one with the money. And that, for me, that comes out not when something goes right. When things are going right, you can do all these systems you've got, you can do all these good intentions, you can do, you know, enlightened philanthropy, and it's great. What happens when something goes wrong? What I've seen is that when something goes wrong, when someone runs off with the money, when there's a crisis or a change of leadership or something bad happens, it's very easy, if you have the money, to revert back to other ways of working because you're scared. You know, your funders are going to be pushing you. The law might be pushing you. So I think there are limits to progressive philanthropy. And I'd be really interested to hear Varya's reflections on whether that's true and where those limits might be.
Are there limits to progressive philanthropy? I mean, I think, yes. I mean, I think there's different models out there. There's Mackenzie Scott's kind of model, right? And there's the effective altruism model, and there's the, you know, give well model. I mean, there's lots of ways to try to get at, you know, what's the best way to give away funding in a way that tries to upend that power structure. And I think, Duncan, rather than saying that CoImpact has figured it all out and we have the perfect formula and that we'll never get into some sort of a sticky situation, I mean, I think it's about acknowledging the things that you've put forward and to sort of say, you know, up until now, we haven't had a situation. Mind you, we are fairly young as an organization. We've actually been giving funding for about 5 to 6 years. So, you know, watch the space in a sense as our own experience grows as well. We have had situations, obviously, which are, you know, unforeseen. I mean, including, you know, we supported partners through COVID. We've supported partners through leadership change, et cetera. So far, nothing has happened that would really upend some of our basic values, which is things like, think about the people and the organization that you're supporting. It's not just about the work that you're trying to pay for, but you're trying to support an organization that really matters in that context. And what is it that organization needs to get through a tough time, for example. And many of us within CoImpact have actually been on the side of working for, you know, being like at the grantee organization, if I want to call it that way. And so we have a very visceral sort of a sense of what kind of a funder we would like to have and what kind of funder we would like to be. So in terms of the limits of, broadly speaking, limits of progressive philanthropy, I mean, I don't know. I mean, I think collectively I'm excited about a conversation that is happening in the philanthropy field, maybe I think in the development field, perhaps more broadly, about what does it mean to be trust-based? I mean, it's a thing that is used all the time, that term, but like people actually starting to unpack it in much more practical ways and demonstrating things like what Liz was saying, core support, right? And actually having foundations move to providing core support. Because when you do that, actually, it triggers a whole snowball effect in terms of what are you holding people accountable to and how, what is the conversation and what kind of reporting are you asking about? And so actually it does have a significant change in how I think the field behaves. Now, it's incremental, and is it good enough? I don't know, but I'm excited to be part of that shift to kind of push it as far down this line as possible.
I mean, I think there's another possible element to that, Vaya, which is one of the things I'm really interested in is at what point do local civil society organizations, local activists get serious about raising money locally? So this whole question about domestic resource mobilization, which means that you raise money from local altruism, local supporters. Now, that doesn't get rid of power. It doesn't, you know, the power is everywhere, but it changes the nature of the power and it becomes much more linked to local politics. And it strikes me that it's something that the aid business has been really bad at, is actually helping its partners transition away from aid towards other forms of fundraising. There's no fundraisers without borders. You know, there's a Doctors Without Borders, Lawyers Without Borders. There's even a Borders Without Borders for skateboarders. There's no fundraisers without borders. And that just seems insane. We should be sending our best fundraisers over to help local organizations get off aid and get into local domestic, because there's so much altruism and so much altruistic giving going around. Just one number. If you look at zakat, which all good Muslims are supposed to give a 40th of their wealth, usually around Ramadan, that comes to about $2 trillion a year, eight times more than aid. And we're just not helping organizations plug into that kind of altruism, which would move them away from the aid dependence relationship into local politics.
Just want to also jump in, just in terms of great models of local mobilization of funding and having powerful philanthropists in country. If you think about Gift of the Givers in South Africa, really powerful global funding organization, but they're homegrown in South Africa. So there are great models that we can build on. There is a capacity gap, which I agree with you, Duncan, and we need to start building that capacity for local fundraising, but there isn't necessarily also the same norms around fundraising, which we need to sort of start thinking through. But there's some really strong philanthropic movements that are locally based, particularly in Africa, that we are tapping into and should be doing more, and then maybe sharing those models globally. So maybe that's a joint project we can all work on together, because I think that's such a good idea. Going back to the question, basically we need long-term unattached funding. That's what we need to be able to create really powerful civil societies. And whether it comes locally or internationally, that's what we need to be developing. And we're talking about within our field, and as someone that Laurie Heisey talks around, is the missing middle, that the sort of the local NGOs that need to be developed and be able to take on the big ODA grants that we aren't able to do because we don't have reserves, for example, to do milestone projects. So there's some structural barriers that we have to be thinking about, but there is thinking about it. So I am quite optimistic about that. The question to you, Duncan, was around change and how change happens. And you talk about the importance of collective action. So I think, you know, that's sort of building on the need to build local philanthropy, identifying the different actors, and you talk about unusual suspects or unusual allies to be working together collectively to address a particular issue. Could you share a particular example from your experience of where that has worked, and what do you think it was that made that work?
One of the things that has gone up the agenda massively in the last few years is this whole question of social norms, and can activists intentionally shift social norms towards a more just, less exclusionary normative framework. And I think there we are all basically looking to feminists who've been doing this for decades and thinking what can we learn from what they've done and the campaign. So just a couple of examples going back over the years. Really interesting example in South Asia where feminists took an example from Uganda, adapted it. They created a sort of viral system of norm shift where people would send off in the campaign called We Can End Violence Against Women. They would send off for a little pack of images of typical situations of domestic violence and commit in return for receiving that pack to talk to 10 friends and neighbors and try and get them to send off for the packs. And so it was a kind of viral marketing scheme around domestic violence. 4 million people sent off for the packs. This is South Asia we're talking about. The numbers are usually big, but that was big. And in terms of unusual suspects, half of the people sending off for packs were men. So I think that was really interesting in terms of a model, in terms of using an African-based campaign and adapting it to South Asian realities. They had a whole image on you know, mother-in-law violence against daughter-in-law, because that's a particular problem in many countries in South Asia. And it was just really interesting. But before we get too kumbaya about it, when they did the evaluation at the end, the people who are most active in the campaign, the percentage of women who said, it's okay for my husband to beat me if I put too much salt in the dal, had gone down from, I think, 60% to 30%. So one in three women still thought domestic violence was justified if they put too much salt in the dal. So it's making progress, but it's not like curing everything overnight. But I think this whole question of norm shifts and going back further, you know, how did they end foot binding in China? Appalling practice at the start of the 20th century, smashing young girls' feet. They ended it in a generation. How did they do that? Great success on female genital cutting in many countries in Africa. You know, there are so many campaigns which have involved unusual suspects, have involved leadership, have involved intentional attempts to change norms. But there's also been massive backlash on things like LGBTQI rights and things like that. So I think this is a whole, not a new field, but it's a field which has become much more prominent. And we have to become much more sort of conversant and literate with these efforts at norm change, rather than always thinking that the target is to change a policy commitment, to change some spending, to change a ministry. It's this norm shift stuff, which I think is becoming more and more crucial to what we're talking about.
Thank you, Duncan. I want to drill deep into the social norms change, because I think it's also a very ideological approach to the world. And we're coming in with an assumption around norms and what does that look like on the ground. And I think we'll be talking about that in a future podcast around how do we evaluate and whose values are driving those sorts of evaluations of what works and what doesn't on the ground. Varya, from you, how does co-impact define success if you're thinking around issues around social norms change, around big structural changes within countries? And do you also have an example of something that you are really proud of as co-impact that you've seen has been effective? I don't want to say sustainable, because I'm not sure what sustainable looks like, because if we don't have local players running it, and we don't know what sustainable looks like without really good longitudinal data. But I agree with you, definitely, Duncan, we can make change within project cycles and within one generation. So I'm optimistic as well about that. Varya, back to you.
Yeah, thanks, Liz. No, absolutely. There are a lot of examples within, with the program partners that Co-Impact supports and many, many others, actually, in terms of being able to make what Duncan was calling sort of sticky change within systems. Sometimes we call it in Co-Impact, we say you get a change to be baked into the system so that it sort of, you know, stays. And I think this question about, you know, how do you think about social norms as part of that is a really important one, particularly when you're looking at things like, you know, gender-based violence. And so for Co-Impact, when we say systems, we tend to really be thinking about public systems that kind of have the responsibility to deliver some of the basics in health, education, economic welfare to people. And so therefore, public system, you know, kind of equals government. Not only, there's also market systems that are kind of often players within that. But I think when it comes to gender-based violence, you are looking at how some of these systems respond, but you're looking at so much more, right? So we're talking about norms, we're talking about these things that are sort of really baked in into almost, I don't know what to call it, into a common psyche of what is acceptable and what is normal. And so a great example of something of an initiative that is looking at both, right? Both how a formal system responds, but also how do you shift some of those deep-seated sort of convictions and beliefs, is a partner we have in India. It's called Breakthrough. It's an incredible organization. I think many listeners may actually be familiar with it. I think Breakthrough became internationally known because of some of the really impressive campaigns that they were doing against gender-based violence, right? But they also are working deeply in schools. And so here's where the partnership with Co-Impact comes in, is that they have developed a curriculum that has been evaluated in very rigorous, kind of, you know, scientifically rigorous ways to, that if you take both boys and girls through this curriculum of at least, I think, a couple of years, 1 or 2 years, that you get not only a significant shift in gender norms to how people report it, but also you get a significant shift in things like delayed age of marriage, which is so important in some of these contexts. Now, the kind of a incredible journey that Breakthrough is going on is not only asking, how do we take this curriculum and make sure not only that we can get it into hundreds of schools, but we can get it into thousands of public schools in many states in India, right? So like looking at the scale, what is the scale of the problem and how do you work at the scale of the problem? But in addition to the curriculum is really thinking about how do we change the experience of a girl as she goes through secondary school. And it's not just the curriculum, right? I mean, that's a critical part of it, but it's also, what are the teachers doing? How is the school organized? What are the administrators paying attention to or not? What kind of information is the school system looking at and cares about as a outcome of the system itself, right? Not only are girls graduating, of course, that's important, but what else is there that the system... So it's really looking at a much broader way of thinking about both the functionality, the important bits and pieces in the functionality of how a system functions, but also how do these norms actually come to life through that? So it's holding both together. And maybe as a last thought on this, I think there is either it's already been published or is coming out recently, a review of literature for UN Women done by a really great consultancy called Ladysmith on this, what do we know about gender norms and social, so this idea of changing gender norms, right? And I think sort of the spoiler alert is that you can't just work on the norms, but not on the system. And you can't just work on the system, the mechanical bits of the system, but not on the norms. I mean, it sounds almost trite, but it's worth reiterating, I think.
I think, Varya, that just talks to the complexity of social norms change. And, you know, there are really great examples of being able to reduce, for example, violence against women in certain cohorts compared to other cohorts, depending on certain interventions that have clear theories of change and really thoughtful interventions that have been stuck to fidelity and done all the really right things that we know we need to do to be able to shift. But when those interventions have been done with different groups in different ways, we've actually increased violence. So it's that we have to be very thoughtful around how we're doing this work and the ways in which we do it. And there's been some really great work that has shown that we can reduce violence. But going back to your point, Duncan, we haven't reduced it to zero anywhere in the world yet. And so we've got a lot to do to try and understand what that looks like in a long-term way. But there was some work done in Nicaragua, which showed over a period of a project plan that we were able to reduce violence against women, but then the government changed and became much more conservative and all the gains got lost very quickly and we had to start from the beginning. So I'm not quite sure what that story tells us, but it does say in terms of social norms change, we have to do a lot, we have to do it often and over a very long period of time. And Duncan, did you want to jump in on some of the points that we've just been talking about now around sort of social norms being values driven, social norms requiring long-term investment, long-term over time. From your experiences, are those resonating, those sort of key messages?
The whole question on being values driven and on reversals and so on, for me, comes back to one of the big challenges for activists generally is how do you practice evidence-based humility and leadership at the same time? So evidence-based humility says, even when we win, it's often not primarily down to us. It's situations changed, women are going out to work, new technologies, all sorts of things have happened. And whenever there's a win, we take the credit. So success has many mothers in this context. And when things go wrong, we blame the system. I don't think that's a particularly useful way of seeing the world. So I think it's like, how do you have a due level of humility without writing yourself out of history to say, well, we can add our little bit, but we have to acknowledge the importance of the wider system and wider processes of change. And we're just like a secondary contributor on top of that. So that's one thing. In terms of values, I think there's a real issue there where sometimes activists say, no, these are not values. These are human rights conventions from the UN. But, you know, that's a political process which reflects who has most voice at the UN. So I think that's slightly disingenuous. So I think And when we ignore that question of whose values are we talking about, we're laying the ground for backlash. So I think there is a real question there about values, which I think is a really good one to take up.
We often try to end on a question around, are you optimistic? Are you optimistic that change can happen? And what are your thoughts on that?
Yes, I'm absolutely optimistic. And I think as Co-Impact, we are very optimistic. I mean, I think What we have seen is that there is no shortage of incredible organizations in working in the context that they are from. So they have the politics, the relationships, they have the longevity, they understand systems, they're working with government and other actors. We have seen in the short amount of time that CoImpact has been supporting these organizations, some real significant shift in some of the core systems that they're trying to change. And we can talk about whether it's improving how children learn, whether it's women having access to maternal and child health. I mean, there's just so many things, positive things that we have seen. And we are just getting started on this in terms of CoImpact, right? So I think absolutely. I mean, the world doesn't fill us with confidence and positivity often, but I think that when we think about the partners we support and what they're doing, then I think absolutely the answer is yes.
Am I optimistic? The older you get and the further you stand back from the day-to-day, the more optimistic you get. So I have the privilege of being old and looking at just how much better things are for my kids than they were for me, and how much better things were for me than for my parents. And this is not just a North situation. You know, it's the sweep of history is amazing. And the last 70 years, yes, climate change, yes, AI, there are always massive existential threats, and they're perhaps more worrying now than they've ever been. But you just look back at the sweep of history for the last 70, 80 years, and it's extraordinary. There's nothing like it in human history. You have to cling to, and a part of that has been done by activism. So you have to cling to that while we worry about all the things that are happening now, just to give you a sense of purpose and direction, I think.
Oh my God, that was such a wonderful point to end on. Thank you so much, Duncan and Varia and the team for pulling this all together. That was a really, really, really awesome conversation. Thank you very much. Thank you to our guests, Varia Lipovsek and Duncan Green. We've lined up loads more incredible speakers for the rest of this new series, so make sure to subscribe to the podcast so you never miss an episode. I am Elizabeth Dartnell, and you've been listening to the Sexual Violence Research Podcast by the SVRI. To find out more about our vision and our work, visit us at svri.org. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time.
This podcast is produced by OG Podcasts. Find out more at ogpodcasts.co.uk.